And then what can you and I do differently so that we see more of leaders having a long-term faithfulness, or as Eugene Peterson writes about, that long-term obedience in the same direction. So that was really what prompted the book. Let's learn from leaders that had this long-term faithfulness. Let's learn from leaders who lost their way and can tell us a cautionary tale. And then let's get real practical of what do we need to do to put these ideas into practicing.
Well, welcome to the Upwards Podcast. My name is Daniel Johnson, the Director of Technology and Media for the S.L. Brown Foundation in Upper House. And so grateful to have on today's episode of the Upwards Podcast, Peter Greer. He is the President and CEO of Hope International, a well-known, well-respected organization throughout the world, and doing amazing work. I first came across Hope when I first actually started here at the foundation back at like 10 years ago. And our executive director, John Terrell, said, hey, there's this organization, you got to know about it. He had been knowing about you guys for a long time, but just the amazing, the work that you guys were doing. So Peter, tell us a little bit about Hope. I know that we're going to focus on the book today, but a lot of your work is reflected out of kind of the experience of leading Hope. And so tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing around the world.
Yeah, and there's no question, all of the writing projects that we've done, we are writing not from a place of expertise, but we're writing about things that we're trying to learn and to model and to put into practice. So unapologetically, we are practitioners. How do we learn about these issues? And then what does it look like for us to put them into practice in the mission of Hope International? And I mean, you mentioned John, but a lot of connection in the broader space of faith and work and the way that those two come together. And so for Hope International, we're an organization that invests in the dreams of families in the world's underserved communities as we proclaim and live the gospel. And so really providing investment capital, training, coaching for entrepreneurs in places of poverty so that they can they already have the skills, they already have the hard work, they already have the hustle. We just allow them to get the tools that they need to really expand and create jobs in the places where we serve. So that's what we do. That's the day job that I have with Hope International, currently working in 30 nations, started in Eastern Europe, started in Ukraine, but now work throughout Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Latin America as well. So part of an incredible global team, but really trying to invest in entrepreneurs through the tools of microfinance and savings group and small and medium enterprise, with coaching, capital, and the gift of being in community with others. So that is that's the backdrop for this conversation. That's the backdrop of what I do with Hope International.
Well, Peter, I want to dive into this newest book. It's so good. We were talking earlier about it. I think leaders out there need to get this book, invest time into it. You talk a lot about your own experience, which we'll get to as you kind of do this. And as you're talking about being a practitioner within the structure of how you lead, even in your organization. But what inspired you to write How Leaders Lose Their Way? Like, what was there a moment or something that kind of a light bulb came on for you that inspired you to take this journey?
There were a couple moments, but I guess this journey really started a decade ago when we wrote a book called Mission Drift. And in that book, we look at how organizations move away from their founding mission and identity and purpose and just how subtle drift is. And over the past 10 years, we've continued to have a strong interest in this of how do we make sure that we stay centered on Christ? How do we make sure that we are a mission-true organization? But over the last 10 years, my guess is you and I have also seen not just how organizations lose their way, but how leaders lose their way. And in many ways, when we hear whatever the latest story is this week of a leader that somehow, oftentimes headlines are not because they're doing such a great job living faithfully and staying on mission. Normally it's something else. Started to ask this question of how did this happen? But I think a better question is not how did this happen in their life, but how do we make sure that that is not our story? And then the second kind of pivotal moment is we read this study that said that in Scripture, 1 out of 3 leaders finish well, meaning they didn't significantly abuse their position or privilege and go seriously off track. And that study concluded by saying it probably is the same percentage today that approximately one out of three leaders finish well. And then again, you combine that with looking around and you do see that not everyone who starts well finishes well. Not every story of this incredible, you know, time and season, oftentimes it seems common that there's a very different ending. And so again, as I said, we're not writing because we figured this out, but I simply say one out of three finishing well is too low. Let's go three for three with the team that we have at Hope International, with the friends that we have. Let's say, what is at the root of this? What is at the root that derails two out of three leaders? And then what can you and I do differently so that we see more of leaders having a long-term faithfulness, or as Eugene Peterson writes about, that long-term obedience in the same direction? So that was really what prompted the book. Let's learn from leaders that had this long-term faithfulness. Let's learn from leaders who lost their way and can tell us a cautionary tale. And then let's get real practical of what do we need to do to put these ideas into practice in our own life.
Yeah, that's so powerful. You talk a little bit about drift being the default. I think that's a really interesting piece coming out of the mission drift piece, where you guys looked at kind of organizations and how they've drifted off of mission over the years. One of those experiences that you had that you talk about in the book was writing your own eulogy. And just how it was such a powerful experience for you as a leader. I'm wondering if you could kind of dive deep with us into what prompted that, you know, and then what came about from that as you're thinking about kind of drift as the default in this situation. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I grew up in New England, and every summer we would go, and my parents were big into the outdoors and worked at a camp on Lake Winnipesaukee and spent enough time in a canoe to know that if you stop paddling, you do not stay in the same place, even though it might seem like you are, but there are currents that are taking you and you never drift to where you want to go. Like, that always requires two things. It requires an identification of what is the destination that we're looking at. And again, when the waves get a little bit bigger, you have to have that clearly articulated point. You have to have that destination. And then the second is you got to do the work. Grab the paddle and keep paddling in that. And I think those two pieces is why this analogy kind of resonated with me of drift. Like, we got to start with the destination, and then we've got to know how do we do the work daily. And so the first part of that relates directly to that exercise of writing your eulogy. This is something that I read from David Brooks, and he talked about the difference between eulogy virtues and resume virtues. And for me, this was one of the most powerful moments of watching my grandfather, literally being with him as he went from this life to the next, and being surrounded by family, watching the reaction of my grandma, his wife, of, you know, 60 plus years, and just this moment of knowing everyone in that hospital room knew that that was a life that was well lived. That was a life on purpose. And so I think it was those two things that on a Saturday morning, I said, I want to have clarity on what my destination is. And I want to untangle these eulogy virtues from the resume virtues by writing my eulogy in it. And my wife came down and I was getting teary, and she asked what I was doing. And I said, I'm writing my eulogy. And I didn't give any other context in that moment. That caused significant amount of concern for her. I was like, what are you doing on that? So if you're doing this, give a little more context perhaps to those that might discover you doing this exercise. But it was so helpful. And this might be crazy, but I put it on my calendar that every year I read it on my birthday. Because that's just a marker, right? I'm 1 year closer to that. And it just is helpful. I don't want to wake up someday and realize that I have drifted from what I say matters. I want every year to be reminded of that. I want to connect that. And the assumption here is that we're all drifting. The assumption here is every single one of us has areas that we need to come back to that North Star. We need to come back to that clarity of what we say matters most in our lives. And then to do the gut check, to do the life check, to do the head, heart, and hands, are we living in alignment with what we say matters most? And again, my assumption for me and my assumption for everyone is there are areas that constantly require micro recalibrations if we're going to have that long obedience in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Reminds me of Donald Miller. I know that, this is a practice that he has done is in the past. And I think he quite often, maybe even daily, reads through that eulogy that he had written as a framework. He talked a little bit about the eulogy being never mentioning work, I think, in the book. It was all about other virtues in there. We spend so much of our lives, and especially leaders, spending so much of our lives impacting, leading well in our organizations, all those things. Was that a shock to you when it didn't come up? I mean, it wasn't on your eulogy, all these years of leading well in organizations. What was your reflection as a leader in an organization and a great ministry like Hope is? How did you think about that?
Yeah, and if I could, I strongly recommend if you want to kind of recalibrate your life, two letters to write or two things to write. One is your eulogy, and the second is your resignation letter. And both of those, is this a depressing podcast episode? We're talking about
No,
eulogy and
no.
resignation, but I think it's so helpful because eulogy reminds us that this life is finite. Resignation letter reminds us that the title that we have is finite, and there's going to be someone else who'll be sitting in the chair that we're in and the position that we're in. There's someone else who's going to be doing the podcast. There's a day that you will not be doing that, right? And so for all of us, I think to hold a little bit less tightly onto title and role, and a little bit more, hold on a little bit more tightly to issues of a deeper identity. There are things that are going to change the day that I leave Hope International, but there's a lot of things that are not going to change in that moment. And so I think to remember those, and I think those two letters for me are anchoring or grounding in reminding myself of what is true and what is going to matter most. So I think those two things really help, but no surprise. And one just real simple, example of this is I think on a micro level, when a staff member leaves Hope International, and we have the opportunity to celebrate them, and when they share the most significant moments, you know what they almost always share? They share about little interactions with teammates that they felt known, loved, and supported. And they don't mention oftentimes the big things of the accomplishments. They talk about relationships. They talk about people in that. And I think that is in alignment with the way that we are wired. And so oftentimes in our work, we over-index on accomplishments and metrics, and we under-index on relationships. And I think those two exercises help me recalibrate, refocus, and hopefully live differently today in the work that I do, seeing, honoring, valuing people, and not just what is accomplished through the organization, even though I care deeply, deeply, deeply about the mission of Hope International.
So in this drift as a default area, you write that drift happens subtly and slowly. What are some of the early warning signs leaders should be watching out for?
Oh, so many. And this is really where we tried to get practical on this. And almost like when we found mission drift, we were trying to find at an organizational level, what are those one or two things that we need to pay attention to? And we didn't really find them. We found it's the drift happens. And the reason it's so difficult to see is because of its subtlety. The reason it's so hard is because you only can see when you have a significant amount of time. And I would say, in the same way, the things that we're trying to do is not identification when some significant drift happens. We're trying to go upstream, and pun intended, we're trying to go upstream and the small compromises in thoughts, attitudes, and actions. And so, maybe just a couple that as we looked at this that were really convicting in my own life. One, talking about this with a colleague, but the reality is, it is really hard to identify drift when you're going really, really fast. And I don't know about you, but every day there is more to do than time to do it. And so we go at a pace, and recognizing drift requires the internal RPMs to slow down and to look around and see where we are individually. And so again, I think we are hardwired to need one out of seven to truly unplug. We need one out of seven. And I was struck on this because I was doing some editing on the book on what I said was a day of rest, the full ability, but we can't see drift when we're going too fast. So maybe that's one piece. When was the last time we truly slowed down that? Number two, there should be a blinking red light if we know things about ourselves that no one else knows about us. It was amazing to me that we all have this box inside of us, and the box inside of us are things that we know about ourselves, but no one else really knows. And the more that is in that box, that should be a blinking red light. Isolation is dangerous on this. And so I think the question is, what's in your box? How many things are in the inside? And I think a lot of us, you know, we believe this false narrative that, oh, if I shared this, what would people think of me? Or if people really knew that I'm having a hard time in this area. And so what do? We stuff. We depend it's not there, and those stories don't end well on that. So that might be another inventory issue of how much do we have in our box, and who are those people that we're doing life with? Or are we just stuffing and compacting issues and hoping that they don't come out? And again, those stories break my heart. Those stories don't end well on that. So pace matters. The gift of friendship matters in it. And anyway, I could go on, but those are maybe some of the things to recognize that maybe there might be a slow drift that might not be a big deal today, but you compound that by months and years, and it will lead you to a very different destination.
Makes me think of some checks and balances. You know, I think leaders sometimes don't feel the need to have checks and balances. You know, it's really great when we have a board we have to report to, or whether it's an elder board or a board for your organization, or a supervisor, or, you know, always having some type of kind of check and balance. I also think of family life as a check and balance within the structure of that, right? So some leaders are great with their family, and some leaders are terrible family members. And so it's just an interesting way to see that and not just stuff and say, okay, well, this is just a busy season, which there is truth to that, right? But to really have some checks and balances, I think, is really important in that mix.
Yeah, I had one leader tell me, he said, my away game was better than my home game. And I knew it on that, right? You can go and you can have your time with others, but it's much more difficult to have a strong home game as well. I appreciated how he shared that as well. But yeah, no, well said. Those are issues that are... and the great myth, right, is that the issues that we're dealing with, that others aren't dealing with it as well. My guess is if you do start having the conversations, if you do have the courage and bravery to start sharing a little bit more, you're going to find, without question, the response, you too, on that, right? Like it's for all of us. We're all dealing with different pieces.
Yeah.
And the sooner that we have people to share that with, thoroughly convinced, and even more after doing this research, thoroughly convinced that that is good for us, good for relationship, and is necessary if we really want to live and serve well.
I think that's interesting. So I want to move us a little bit into part two of the book around the misguided pursuits. And the first section, there's some great sections, and we're not going to cover all of them. So I would encourage people to purchase the book and read them all. There are two that I want to highlight, and two from probably a little bit of a different angle. So I want to get your take on a couple of these. So the two that really stood out to me, the first one was achievement. And, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, I'm not a senior leader in our organization. You know, I'm not at the top of the org chart by any means. And I'm sure this is true of people that are in the top of the org chart 100%. But so much, I think, of those in my position and other positions throughout an organization is achievement. I mean, we're wanting to push into areas to do really good work, to help the organization, but also advance our own, you know, our own pursuits organizationally with job titles or areas of responsibility, those type of things. And so I was just really struck by this, you know, this chapter, this section of the book. How can ambition become an idol in mission-driven work? How do you see that?
Yeah, and that's really interesting, isn't it? An idol in mission-driven work. I think in some ways it's even more of an issue when you really do believe passionately in the work that you're doing. You really do have that inner sense of calling, and you know this work matters, and we want to go after it. We want to achieve. Absolutely. And I would just say, nothing wrong with that. Like, let's go after big and bold dreams. Let's go after professional development. Let's not be afraid to step into new roles when we have them. Absolutely. And your question, how do we know when that slowly becomes an elevated place of priority in our life that is not healthy? And in the book, I mean, I love how scripture is just, yeah, written a long time ago, but so relevant. And one of the case studies that we dive into is the case study of Solomon, where he, I mean, talk about success, talk about achievement. Doesn't matter the category, from a military perspective, from a political perspective, from an author perspective, whatever it is, whatever perspective, he achieved everything at that time. And then whether it was him or someone writing as if it was him, you kind of read through the book of Ecclesiastes and he says, I missed it. I missed it. And the word that he uses, that havel, that breath, that mist, that vapor. And he says it all was so fleeting. And I don't think that is an ancient issue. I think that has a whole lot of modern relevance, that even if we get our achievement, even if we get that title, even if we get that next big bump, I think that we are hardwired to actually have a law of declining return when it comes to that, which actually I think points us to finding our ultimate fulfillment outside of anything that we could achieve. And I like that one quote that someone said, the two most happy, unhappiest people in the world. One are those who never achieve what they want to achieve, and the second are those who did achieve it. Either way, it ends up not doing what we think it will do. And so I would just say, like, achievement, absolutely, let's go. But let's make sure it is not in a place of higher priority of knowing the gift of saying that we are adopted into God's family because of what Jesus did. Like, I have an identity that is independent of what I do. Oh, that just changes everything. We still go after it. We still work hard. But it's not because we need to achieve. Yeah, it's from a place of a belonging and love. Yeah, what does it say? We love others because Christ first loved us. And I increasingly, I want that to be my motivation. Receive that love and then find ways of sharing it with others. That's what I want to be a part of.
Yeah, I think you talked a little bit about identity. It's such a important piece of our own development, just as leaders, as within our family structures, leading organizations, but it's a really culturally difficult thing. And I think right now, I think everyone's looking for their identity, trying to find it. How are identity and achievement related? Where do things go wrong? And maybe where do things go right between those two?
I mean, I'm just thinking of my own life and what we previously talked about. The fact that writing my eulogy and writing my resignation letter both prompted tears might tell me for different reasons. Maybe I've got some work that needs to be done on that. But I think that's a really interesting thing. And you were talking earlier about what are some of the ways to see this. I think that one of the most important signs of whether or not we have a sense of identity that is slowly mixed with our sense of self-worth is how we think about succession planning at every level of an organization. Because if it is primarily about, hey, what can you achieve? What can you do? How can you make sure you're there on the next? I think that oftentimes means we're not going to have a posture of delegation. We're not going to have a posture of empowering others. We're going to focus on what we can do. And I just find that those individuals that have a sense of identity outside of what they do, ironically, they are free to share. They are free to invite others to take on. They are constantly focused on not just what can I do, but how can I help you be successful. And then what happens? Those, ironically, are the individuals that are promoted that actually do achieve far more impact because their focus is not on self. It is an outward focus. And that builds amazing cultures. It builds amazing teams and, ironically, helps individuals actually achieve those goals. But it's from a very different place of origin in it. So, yeah, I think that, and really everything that we're talking about, how do we just get ourselves off of center stage? Like, how do we just focus on a bigger story and intentionally displace ourselves from center stage? That alone would help so many leaders not drift. That fact alone would allow so many more to live and work with faithfulness as the major descriptor, as opposed to drift.
The podcast notes for today's conversation include a link to view this episode on YouTube. Remember to follow or subscribe to stay updated with our latest episodes in your podcast app.
I want to jump into one of these other misguided pursuits that I think is very, we're in a very interesting cultural moment with it, is power. And so we have seen, I think, power being used in really good ways recently, culturally and politically. We've seen it being used in really negative ways. And I think one of the interesting pieces around power and kind of drift as a default is that, you know, as you gain power, you gain influence typically, you know, with people. What are some of the red flags as a leader that you have identified in misusing power?
I really like what you said too. These all are connected. Like the increase of power leads to more isolation. Increased power leads to a sense of exceptionalism. Like, yeah, the laws, policies, they might apply to others, but they don't necessarily apply to me. And so you see all of these pieces that actually accelerate that and even the acceleration of life. The more you have, the more opportunities, the faster the pace, and the more difficult it is going to be to see that you're slowly going off track. So absolutely, these things move in parallel and accelerate over time. The speed of drift is not constant. It increases based on the different currents that are coming together. And so all that to say is power, and I like how Lord Acton said, right, the famously power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely in it. And so we all need checks on that. We all need opportunities to do that. And so what are some of the ways to do that? I think this is going to be so simple, but to me, I think one of the things that we heard from the leaders that we interviewed that had, you know, this just posture of humility is they regularly did acts of service that were quote unquote beneath their position. And this is nothing new, right? Certain of orders throughout history, manual labor was, I always thought that was just good because you needed someone to do the work. I think it's good for our soul on that. Mm-hmm. And so the tagline for me is clean a latrine. No matter what your position, and maybe even the higher you are in an organization, the more you need to clean a latrine in that. And again, this is going back to the example of Jesus. It's different cultural equivalent, but being willing to wash feet, something that was below, you couldn't even force individuals to do them. And so in our culture, what are the things, what are the tasks that are quote unquote beneath you? And whatever just came to your mind, do it. Do the trash, do it. And don't just do it because it helps in a workplace. Do it because it helps shape your heart and gets you off of the high horse and gets you shoveling the horse manure. That is good for your soul in it. And so I think just practically clean a latrine and just be reminded that, yeah, there is no difference. We are all equal value. And so let's do things that might not be associated with whatever our role or title is.
You're talking a little bit about servant leadership there, which is of all the hope folks that I've connected with over the years, I think that's just an ethos value that you guys have, which just permeates out to kind of everything that you're doing, which I think is a very impactful way of serving the world and serving others, which I think is really unique. Any other practical ways that servant leadership can be an antidote for power, as you think about it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the other maybe related ones is I think about the power of listening. And one of the other challenges is if you go and quote unquote have more power, what does that mean? You're going to have more opportunity to speak and share. And I am not putting this into practice in this podcast, but I'll tell you what I'd rather do is, can I have you on my podcast? And like, I'd love to listen on that. I'd love to hear your take on all these pieces. And so I think just that general speak to listen ratio that I'm doing an extremely poor job right now in this conversation. But I think that's a great, one is, when is the last time you just walked around the office and said, tell me how you're doing? I'd love to know what's going on in your life. Or when was the last time that someone asked you a question and you actually gave an honest response of, I really don't know. What do you think? Maybe that's another way of connecting this. And again, it ironically is good for your heart. It's good for the organization, and actually make sure that, again, we just all people valued, all people something to give, and all people have something that they need to receive as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to jump into part three of the book here. And, you know, going off of the kind of this theme of mission drift, drift as being the default, there are two areas about strong currents that I wanted to kind of highlight, and we'll let our folks read the third one on their own. But speed. So you write, hurry is the devil, which isn't a new concept, but how does speed contribute to drift? How have you seen that kind of play out?
Yeah, and one of the most enjoyable parts of writing the book was I have a friend who has a vehicle that is a much higher performance vehicle than our family's Honda on that. And I was talking with him, and he mentioned that there's something on sport mode. And so he actually took me in the car and showed it to me on this. But when it's in sport mode, the dashboard goes black on that, because the manufacturer knows your focus has to be on a very limited area in front of you. You cannot look to the right. You cannot look to the left. This is not a time to look at the scenery. Your focus needs to be on one area and just what's right in front of you. And I thought that analogy works. The faster we get, the more we are not seeing the impact on our colleagues. The faster we go, we're not even seeing the impact on our family, until something happens that causes us, and normally it's not a good thing, but it causes an immediate change of pace. It causes an immediate slowing down. And then we look to the left and we look to the right, and we see the impact on others that was there building for mile after mile, but we just didn't see it because our focus was on a small window in front of us. And so I think that's really it. Speed is limiting. We don't see the impact on those around us. And that's why, again, it just takes time. Sometimes you got to take that foot off of the accelerator. And this is not a practice that I had put into practice in my life. But if you have never tried a 24-hour time outside of media and outside of the whirlwind, literally get, it will be good for your soul. It will be difficult, but it will be good for your soul. And that is something that I had never put into practice in my life until recently, of like taking longer time. For me, it's getting in nature and just slowing down and actually asking, where am I drifting? Where am I losing track of what matters most?
Yeah. I think the challenge in organizations and staff in organizations is the increased pressure for outputs. You know, we continually have this wheel that we have to process and output. And speed is really like a really wheel that kind of moves that, right? So it's like, oh, you know, what's your capacity for this? What's your capacity for this? And the more speed that you have, maybe the more outputs that you have. One of the things that I think just us organizationally, this has been interesting just to see, and part of it is from our senior leader, but people often will take a 10-15 minute walk just down on campus. We're done right down in the UW campus. And they'll just get out and walk, kind of, you know, be outside, get away from your desk, get away from the constant pressure on the outputs and the speed, to be able to just to be in nature in that. You're talking about a 24-hour Sabbath a little bit in there. How does it cause, I mean, Sabbath is designed by God. It's not something that we just all of a sudden in 2025 discovered, but how have you seen that for leaders when they really implement it? help them to really recalibrate on kind of their vision of how they're doing their work.
I love that example of what you just shared of getting outside and physically getting off the screen in a different context and doing that with others. I love that practice. Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, again, it seems to me that for most individuals, we know that something is wrong when we rise early and we caffeinate as quickly and as hard as possible. And then we reach the end of the day and we need something to help our minds slow down on that. Maybe those are indicators of like the pace is okay for a season. The long-term impact is probably not great. And one of the stories we tell in the book is from an individual named Genna, who just, again, his pace was not sustainable. And in his words, it caused him being on his back in a hospital room for him to have a recognition, like come to his senses. This is because I had been going at a pace that is not a sustainable pace. And again, we're master justification providers of, well, it's just one more week. It's just one more month. And then it turns into year over year over year. And so, again, that's why I love what you said. This is a gift that is hardwired into us. And I think for more of us to receive that gift before it is forced upon us would be a very, very good thing. But yeah, how do you do it? What's that look like in your life?
Oh, I'm terrible at it. So I was really challenged by that chapter. I mean, you know, I think the big thing is, which I have done at moments, been getting back into it kind of later this summer, is just actually have my phone off on Sundays. Just, you know, I actually let the battery run out on Saturday night, like at some point. And so that it's not even charged. And so it's not like even on the charger. And so, you know, if somebody really needs to get out, my wife usually has hers on and whatnot. And so it's been a good, like just a simple practice. You know, I think of that. I also think of, you know, we're huge Green Bay Packer fans here. So we're getting into that season right now. And so it's a communal kind of activity for our family to, we have a screen on, but it's screen with a purpose, which I think is important. And so that's a really fun kind of activity. And I grew up on Sundays coming home from church, eating chili during the winter and watching the Green Bay Packers. Like that was kind of our thing, which was really fun. So, but it inspired me to think well about even implementing some of those into my own life. So, which is great.
Great example. And go Packers.
Yeah.
There we go.
Go Pack, go. The other one that I want to highlight in this section was isolation. I think it's a really interesting piece, especially in kind of the current cultural moment that we're in with Gen Z entering into the workforce. I mean, they're the most isolated generation ever. Part of that is they're, you know, digital natives. They've grown up with this. They're entering into the workforce. I think we're at a really interesting moment with that we're going to really have to help coach Gen Z not to isolate themselves within the structure of the practices of their work and mission-driven work that they have. You talk a little bit about the island effect in there. Talk a little bit about this. Why is that so dangerous? Why is isolation such a dangerous dynamic when we think about mission drift as a leader?
Yeah, I mean, one of the overwhelming things that we found is that those that didn't finish well did not have people that knew them. So why is it so important? You want to finish well, you want to lead well, you want to live well, don't do it alone. That was a consistent theme. So it's essential. And I would say of all the practices that are in the book or that we found, and a lot of them are not new ideas, we just wanted to provide tools that help take ideas and then put them into practice. And so one of them is this idea of constellation mentoring and actually writing down on paper all of the relationships and those people that you're learning with and areas and we call them your core four. Like, who are those people? If it's 3 a.m. and you need four people to carry a stretcher, who are you going for on that? And who are you pouring into and who are you doing life with? And so just trying to create a constellation of relationships as a counterpoint to every single survey that I have seen, every single bit of research says isolation is on the rise. And I think you're right. The ability to feel like we're getting friendship by connecting online, but that is an artificial friendship. That is a curated friendship. That is not doing life together. And again, every piece of data that has come out recently supports that. We need to be in relationship with others. And so again, that constellation mentoring for me was just a very practical way to say, this is what I say matters. These are the people that I want to do life with. And to have that sort of a thing that then is reflected on my calendar. Today, I had a call, as I do every Friday, with a group of, just got on my calendar. I want to do life with a small group. And so we start the day together on Friday, no matter where I am in the world, connect with them as a way of saying, this is an anchor practice. And yeah, no surprises. Let's do life together. It matters. So anyway, if someone's looking for a practical way to start, I would say of all the things we've talked about, consider who's in your life. Be thoughtful about that. Make sure that that is not pushed aside, even with the whirlwind of other activities. You want to live well, you want to finish well, you've got to be in relationship with others who truly know you.
Yeah. As we close, Peter, I want to ask readers of this book, which I hope everyone gets the copy of it. InterVarsity Press is a great, we love InterVarsity Press, and I know that you've done a bunch of work with them in the past. So I go to their website, get the book, and start reading it. As I read through the book, I was really thinking about it in kind of two different, I know that you weren't intentionally writing it this way, but like intentionally two different buckets of people, of leaders within structures. And so one is senior leaders, right? So those, we talked a little bit about the kind of those, the people at the top of the org chart and whatnot. What would you say kind of from this, from the book, you know, if there was a highlight for that senior leader of what they need to be really careful, cautious of, what would you say would be like kind of the top of the list?
My immediate response is believe that no matter what your story is to this point, that there is no guarantee that you are going to finish well. And take it seriously. Again, one of the things that we heard is everyone who lost their way said some version of, all of a sudden, I realized, fill in the blank, or I thought this would never happen to me. I counseled others, but I never thought it would be my story. And everyone was surprised. And so again, for that senior leader, two out of three of you are not going to finish well, according to that one study. So let's make sure that we are under no illusion that it could not happen to us. People more talented, more godly, more disciplined have lost their way than you. So let's take these things really, really seriously. That's what I would love more people to realize, that then leads us to doing some things differently in our life. But we don't do those things unless we believe that finishing well does not automatically happen.
So the other group that I thought of, Peter, when I was reading through the book was the rising leader. You know, so those are people that are, you know, middle managers, people that are leading different initiatives in an organization and those type of things. I think they're similar in, you know, a vision, obviously, connectedness to a mission is really important, especially in church world, nonprofit world, all those places that we're talking about. What would you say is really important to the rising leader?
Yeah, I think about last weekend, our neighbors gathered together because we had this tree that was an invasive tree, and it had been just growing for a long time. And it was a pain in the neck to take down because this thing had grown to a huge scale and multiple trips filling. And you know what happened? If 10 years ago, someone with one pair of clippers, or you could even do it with your hand, had just pulled it up in that moment, it would have saved us a whole lot of time and heartache. And so I would say to those rising leaders, please do not underestimate the importance of the small day-to-day habits and decisions that you make. It doesn't seem like it will make a big deal today, and it probably won't, but the habits and patterns that you establish will make a massive impact. And so I'd say, look in your life. Where are those small trees? Where are those small attitudes, actions, behaviors? What does it look like to actually start pulling them out before they grow to be such a place that really does cause damage to you, to those that you love, and to the organizations that you care about? So I think a little more weeding will help us avoid the giant invasive tree that it took a neighborhood to address last weekend.
That's a great analogy. Such a great analogy. Well, the book is How Leaders Lose Their Way. I would encourage everyone, check out InterVarsity Press to purchase the book. There'll be a link in the show notes that you can click there and purchase the book on your own. But Peter, any last words of wisdom before I close our time here today?
No, just to say thanks for having the conversation. And again, for me, it was not just knowing, but then it's doing. And I think for all of us, it's like, what can we do? What today? What small things can we do today to kind of recalibrate, get back on track? Because come on, one out of three is not good enough. Let's go three for three for those people that we know and care about. And if there's anything that we could do to help, yeah, all the tools are at howleadersloseTheirWay.com as well. I really want to make these ideas actionable and practical. And if there's anything that we can try and do on your journey as well, we'd love to do it. So yeah, thanks so much for the conversation.
Well, thank you, Peter. We really appreciate it. And thank you to our audience. Thanks for tuning in and sticking with us. It's a great book. We encourage everyone to go do that. Well, go in peace.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.